jump into our sermon series here in Ezra through Esther and then Nehemiah. So far in the last 2 weeks, we have covered the first six chapters of Ezra, and in there we were told of the return of some of the captives that the Israelites were out of the land, and after several years they completed the second temple. And last week we saw that under the leadership of Zerubbabel and Joshua, they completed that building, they dedicated the temple, but God's glory did not return in any visible way, which left them kind of asking, so where is God? If he didn't come back to his house, why hadn't he returned? Where is he? And so this week we will pick up the story in chronological order, so we're going to ditch Ezra for a couple weeks, and then we're going to go to the book of Esther. So if you want to head there to the book of Esther, if you need help, it's right in front of Job, which is right in front of Psalms. So here's our timeline here. So we need to do a little bit of filling in the gaps, because if you look at the timeline, Ezra's chapter 1 through 6, I'm going to try and do this backwards for you guys. It's over here. Then there's a gap, and then we have Esther. So what happened in the time frame in between there? They complete the temple right before 515 BC, and Ezra chapter 7 picks up in 458, way over this way. And so what happened during that almost 60-year period? So bringing in a little bit of history as well as a little bit of Bible in filling this in, we see that Darius the first, who had recommitted the Persian Empire to the rebuilding of the temple, he died in 486 BC. His health failed him, and during his final years, Darius had started Persia's campaign against Greece. During this time, Egypt threw a revolt. If all of his attention is towards Greece, maybe we can get out from under the hand of Persia, Egypt being on the edges of the Persian Empire. And so during Egypt's revolt and campaign against Greece, Darius was the king who lost the great Battle of Marathon. Now, if you ever hear the Battle of Marathon story, you always hear it from the Greek side, right? Because there's that guy that ran all the way from Marathon back to tell everybody that they had won. Well, for our purposes here, the Persian Empire, not too happy about that, unlike the people in Greece who were excited that they had fended off the Persian Empire the first time, and that should give you an indication that they're going to do it again. So Darius's health failed, and he died, and so his son Xerxes, although it was not his oldest son, it was one of his oldest sons from the house of Cyrus, who is known as, he's like, the prime king of the Persian Empire. So Xerxes had to wrestle around with his stepbrother for a little bit, but Xerxes then takes the throne of the Persian Empire. Xerxes spends the first 2 to 3 years squelching the Egyptian rebellion that started under his father. So he goes down as the new king of Persia, wipes out the rebellion, establishes himself, and then he returns back to Susa, and he inherits the largest empire known to his time and all of its wealth. At this point, Persia had grown to its greatest extent, and it was bigger than any empire before it. And so Xerxes inherits this massive empire. And so when he goes back to Susa, this is where the story of Esther, chapter 1, picks up the biblical accounts. Again, this does match quite well the historical records that we do still manage to have that the Greeks didn't burn down, that Xerxes was the one who inherited a massive kingdom. In Esther chapter 1, verse 1, this is what it talks about. Now, we're going to talk 1 second here. My translation has Ahasuerus as the name of the king. Yours might have Xerxes. On an off chance, you might have Artaxerxes. This is because there's a lot of confusion about the names, okay? And I can't tell you that with 100% certainty that we're right and we know it, which is why I put Ahasuerus in parentheses under Xerxes. This is our best guess. Based on the description of this king, based on what would be a feasible timeline, it is best understood, we think, that this is Xerxes. Now, Xerxes is a Greek name given to this guy, who has a Persian name that I can't pronounce, okay? But it's sort of almost like Ahasuerus. But Ahasuerus is a Hebrew transliteration of the Persian name Kajarashara, right? I'm not saying that again. And Greece takes Ahasuerus, and that's the transliteration, to which we're all like, are you serious? How does X make a sh sound? Well, Greece doesn't have a sh sound, so the closest thing they have is an XS, actually it would be a KS phonetically, but whatever, a X sound. And so that's what they put instead. So are we all confused? Good, because that's where we should be. The biggest problem that we have had in the last several hundred years of trying to understand Esther is the whole name of the kings. And I think, just to make it very overly simplistic, I'm not saying this is for sure what happens, but we still have a monarch over in England, right? And they take different royal names when they get different jobs, right? So you get a kingly name, and then there's a title and the dukes and duchesses of all the things, right? It's not hard to imagine that that's a similar thing that has taken place in Persia, and because the records are so poor, because they were mostly destroyed, it would not be a surprise that Ahasuerus, Xerxes, Keshura would actually be best be understood some sort of royal title, and one that somebody else would take. Now, you'll notice, like, Cyrus is actually Cyrus II, but he's known as Cyrus the Great, because the Cyrus before him had a really tiny empire, okay? Darius is the first, there's a Darius II after Artaxerxes, and there's a second Artaxerxes, and I think there's a third Darius, but they weren't all literally named that from birth. They took those names as they ascended to the throne, okay? All that to say, this is my best guess, that Xerxes is the guy we're talking about. So if you know Xerxes because you like Greek history, think of Xerxes. As you read your Bible, if it says Ahasuerus, still think Xerxes, same guy. Best that we can figure, okay? That's my historical note for the day. We're going to move on past that. But what we do see in verse 1 of Esther 1 is that in the days of Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, I'm going to say Xerxes is easier, who ruled 127 provinces from India to Kush. This is the Indus River, which is almost India. It's actually border of Pakistan and India, depending on how far over the river he made it. To Kush is modern-day Ethiopia. And to help us all out, I have a map. You're welcome. The white boxes are things that I added, so if you're mad about the geographical location of them, you can get mad at me. The rest of the map I did not do. This is the kingdom that was reached its greatest extent under Darius, and I understand that our projector has some coloring thing, so I drew a giant black line around everything, okay? So we have down in Ethiopia, all the way to Pakistan, India, Afghanistan's in there, Iran, Iraq, Turkey up in there, that part, that yellow part over there is also part of Turkey today, and then you'll notice up to the north, and I include these just because of the news being what it is, you have Ukraine right above the Black Sea, Crimea, which has been an interesting thing in the last couple of years, and then Russia up there as well. In case you're wondering, there are tons of other countries in there as well. I just didn't feel like we needed to know that. Just geographically, this is what we're talking about. It also might be a little bit hard, so I'll use my cool laser pointer. Over here, this yellow star is Susa, and this blue star over here is Jerusalem, okay? Just for geographical bearings. This is the empire that Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, as it is written in Esther, inherit from his father, Darius I. So, let's jump in to Esther chapter 1. In those days, Xerxes reigned from his royal throne in the fortress at Susa, the yellow star. He held a feast in the third year of his reign because he spent the first two and a half years squelching the rebellion down in Egypt. He held a feast for his officials and staff, the army of Persia and Media, the nobles and the officials from the provinces. He displayed the glorious wealth of his kingdom and the magnificent splendor of his greatness for a total of 180 days. So this is our first major scene in the story of Esther, is that Xerxes now has asserted himself onto the throne, established that he is actually the king worth respecting, and so he goes back to his Susa, his little city there with a nice big palace, and he displays his glory, his splendor, for 6 months, okay? I'm not going to, for time's sake, read this entire thing, but one thing to note is that He displayed his greatness for 6 months. This doesn't mean that every day for 6 months they were eating and partying. The whole army of Persia and all of the government officials all came to Susa. Because if you have a giant kingdom like this and you took your entire government and located it in one town for 6 months, do you think you'd have an empire worth going back to? So what seems likely is that he kicks this celebration off and then it lasts for 6 months, but guests are rotating in and out. Okay, got people from this area, got government officials coming through. This kind of looks like one big celebration for his success at squashing the rebellion down in Egypt, but also probably serves as a launching pad for what he intends to do next, which is to pick up where his father Darius had left off to try and conquer the Greeks. So during this 6 month time, he displays his greatness by showing all of his wealth. Basically, you can read through here, he puts gold and silver couches, yes, gold and silver couches, out and about. He has royal banners and gold and silver everywhere, and precious metals and things of that nature. Beverages at this party for 6 months were served in gold goblets, each with a different design. And royal wine flowed freely according to the king's bounty, and no restraint was placed on the drinking. So at the end of this six-month-long party, there was then a week-long party, which gives us an indication that the six-month party wasn't a six-month long-term, like just one big 180-day party. It was that people were coming in and out. At the end of this 180 days, which just seems to be more government and army-related, he throws a one-week party for everybody. He says anyone in town can come and celebrate for a whole week. So a bunch of guys come, and he says, you know, let's eat, drink, and celebrate. And so they do, and that's what the story is. During this one-week party, his queen, Queen Vashti, also was giving a feast for the women of King Xerxes' palace. Now, this could have been his harem, but it's also likely that it would match well with the fact that he's giving an open house party to all his male buddies, and now she's giving an open house for all the women buddies. Okay, during this, he wants to display all of his glory. So then, in verse 10, comes the inciting moment of this whole narrative. On the seventh day, so after a whole week, the king was feeling good from the wine, is what my translation says. Xerxes commanded a bunch of these guys, the seven eunuchs who personally served him, to bring Queen Vashti before him with her royal crown. He wanted to show off her beauty to the people and the officials because she was very beautiful. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command that was delivered by the eunuchs. And the king became furious and his anger burned within him. So as the party was reaching its conclusion, Xerxes decided that he had one last great treasure to display his splendor, his queen. And although that statement could almost sound romantic, he treasured his wife more than all his wealth and splendor. He saved her for last because it was the most important thing to him was his wife. His actions demonstrate that he did not value Vashti for who she was, but for what she could present favorably for him. He treated her more or less like property. Xerxes sent an official decree while drunk, to bring Vashti to the drunken male party to display her beauty. Now, we don't know from this text exactly what Xerxes was telling Vashti to do. Could have said, you know, come and do a dance for us. Could have been very wildly inappropriate for all we know. But what we do know from this text is that she would have been on display for drunken men to gawk at. So when Vashti heard what Xerxes wanted, she bravely refused to come and display herself. Regardless of if she was wearing clothes or not, she said, no, I don't want to be put on a little stage and then have a bunch of drunken men looking at me. It's because I'm so beautiful. So Vashti tells the king of Persia, nope, not happening. So, no surprise, this causes quite the stir on the men's side. In the following verses 13 through 22, the drunken guys just try to decide, what are we going to do? The way the story is told, Xerxes immediately gets furious, consults with his advisors, who are also inebriated, as to what he should do. One of the men suggests that the king take Vashti's crown away and send her into exile and replace her with a new queen. Okay? They say, like, hey, not only has Vashti wronged the king, she's also going to cause a major problem for the empire, so let's de-queen her and send her away and let somebody else become queen. So that seemed like a good idea to Xerxes, who probably had quite the harem already. So he has one queen, but a bunch of other women he sleeps with. And so they're like, well, just take the crown away from her and give it to one of your other ladies. Like, no big deal, right? And Xerxes is like, sure, let's do it. And then he orders Vashti deposed and then issues a decree sent throughout Persia, who is actually known for having a really good mail system, probably a little bit better than our own, that all men should have absolute authority in their own kingdoms or their homes. And then let's look at this for just one second, because this verse gets really confusing. So verse 22 of chapter 1. He sent letters to all the royal provinces, to each province in its own script, and to each ethnic group in its own language. So he's making sure everybody gets it and hears it and reads it in their own language, that every man should be master of his own house. And then this last clause, no, like, is super confusing. Like, I'm trying to figure out what in the world it means. And speak in the language of his own people. Has absolutely nothing to do with what Vashti just did, okay? Somehow it gets tagged in, okay? You can put this as it should be, that it needs to be decreed in everyone's house in the language that the man of the house speaks. That doesn't really work grammatically, and we won't get into it too much. Best I can tell, it kind of looks like it's just like a little tack on, like as an example of like the guy should have every authority to just do whatever he wants, as well as dictate what language gets spoken in his own household. Okay, because you have a lot of intermarrying going on in an empire this big, that there's probably a little bit of a dispute. So it seems weird to put that in there, because the queen didn't say, like, I'm not going to learn to speak your own language. But if you think about it, right, the setting, a bunch of drunken guys hanging out for a whole week. Some lady says no to one of them. And, you know, one of these other guys might have been like, you know, I've been having this problem in my house too. My wife wants me to learn, you know, Japanese, and I'm not into it. And so I should be able to say, I'm the man of the house, right? So, like, it's one of those things where maybe it just got kind of, like, woven in there. So then the guy who home and like, what am I supposed to do, honey? The king says that you got to listen to me. It seems like the reaction is to make sure that the law of the land says that you listen to your husband. The whole language part, best guess, okay? We don't really know. But that is the message that gets sent out. So Xerxes is furious. His queen refuses to come when he tells her to come. Says, you must come. She says, no. So he gets furious, has her deposed. It doesn't say anything about having her executed, just, you're dequeened. We're going to give this crown to somebody else. Okay? So this is where the story starts off. That's the inciting moment. Xerxes is trying to display his glory to his whole empire, to everybody, partying, celebrating, because I just squashed a rebellion in Egypt. He's having a great time. He's been partying for 6 months and a week, and then at the end of the week, his wife is like, nope, not coming. And so he gets furious, right? So what happens next? In Esther chapter 2, as the biblical narrative goes, there will be the next part of the story. However, a couple years lapses in this time frame. Okay, so somewhere I should back up on the timeline so I don't get this wrong. So Xerxes starts in 486. This party would have started in 483. Somewhere in 480, 481, I would like to just try and tie it into this narrative. He deposes Vashti. He's super ticked off about it. He channels that anger and then goes attacks the Greeks. Okay? Historically, he went and attacked the Greeks. I don't know if it's because he was mad at his wife. I don't know. But he channels his anger to go fight the Greeks during the end of the 480s. Again, dates are a little bit questionable in this time frame. But this campaign was unsuccessful, just like Darius was unsuccessful. He tried to go take over Greece, and it did not work. And Xerxes wasn't really involved in the whole thing at the beginning anyway. He gets involved, then it starts failing, then he disappears, and Persia and Greece fight on and off, but Xerxes himself goes back to Susa, discouraged by the failure. He's like, well, I wanted to be greater than my dad, but this ain't working so good. So he goes back to Susa. When he comes back, he's not in a very good mood. And then I think in 480-ish, and it picks up in Esther chapter 2. Sometime later, so a couple of years after he just failed to defeat the Greeks, King Xerxes' rage had cooled down. He remembered Vashti, what she had done, and what was decided against her. So he comes home to Susa after fighting a war that he lost, and then he's like, where's my wife? Oh, right. Yeah, we deposed her. And then he's kind of upset about it. So he just lost to the Greeks. He's back home, and he doesn't have his beautiful wife anymore. So then his officials come to him and say, hey, let's have a contest. Let's have a big search for all the beautiful young women for the king. Let the king appoint commissioners in every province. Again, won't get into the I'll summarize these details. Feel free to be reading as I am talking. So he returns, remembers Vashti, how he missed her, yet could not undo his drunken decree. He can't just go back and be like, oh, I was, my bad. He can't do that. And that's going to be a theme. That's been a theme in the book of Daniel, that you can't undo one of the king's decrees. And you can make another decree that makes it harder for the other decree to be done, but you can't just go undo it. So since no woman had officially been chosen to replace her as queen, although he had plenty of women on the side already, his advisors suggest a contest, but not one like Miss America, okay? Now maybe we get this concept in here. It sounds almost like a Disney princess movie, right? Oh, the king or the prince needs to find a woman to marry, so then we're going to have this big old ball for everyone to come to. This one is a little bit less cool. So they were sent on a search to find a woman who pleased Xerxes well enough for him to forget Vashti. I mean, that's the bottom line. He came home, he was depressed, realized he didn't have his beautiful wife any longer that was going to cheer him up. So now they were trying to find a wife that at least makes him forget his first one. Okay? They suggest to round up all the beautiful women throughout the empire and bring them to the king's official harem. He could then call for a new woman from this group whenever he chose. After spending the night with them, the woman would be in the official royal harem and would only return to Xerxes if he asked for her by name. Yes, you heard that right. Rounded up all the young, beautiful women, took them to Susa, and said, you are now the king's. You get one night to let the king do whatever he wants to with you, and then you get put to the second harem, and only if he ever remembers your name is he going to call for you again. And this is how we're going to find a wife, a new queen, that makes him forget Vashti. Sounds great, right? So the contestants were then put under supervision of one of the king's eunuchs, Haggai, for beauty treatments and training. And it is now in Esther chapter 2 that we are finally introduced to two of the main characters for the rest of the book. The two new characters are Mordecai and Hadassah, who is called Esther. Okay, Hadassah was an orphan, and Mordecai was her cousin, who kind of had more or less like an uncle relationship. It was one of those generation-removed cousins. It's kind of difficult. So if you hear that it's an uncle, it's just like you say Uncle Bob. You know, it's one of those. They're not really an uncle, but close enough. He had adopted her because her parents were dead and raised her apparently from a pretty young age. Mordecai and Hadassah had been living in Susa at the time. Now, let's take for a quick second a break here. We have Mordecai and Hadassah, who are Jewish in heritage, living in Susa after Cyrus had said, hey, if you want to go back to Jerusalem, you can. But apparently there were plenty of Jews still living in Susa and all over the rest of the Persian Empire that were like, no, we like it here. We're going to stay. Now, we can't read too much into this, but But there is something to be said about names in the biblical narrative as well. Most people in this time frame had more than one name that they were known by. And so if an author uses one name over another, it could, doesn't mean it does, but it could mean something significant. So let's look at some names here. We already talked about Ahasuerus, which is a transliteration of Xerxes, or Artaxerxes, which is unsure. It kind of means great king, a king of heroes. It's a royal name. Vashti, that name means like sweetheart, or more accurately, probably goodness and beauty. So it's kind of like a pet name. It's not even like her official name. It's just like a name, right? It's something that Xerxes called her. Mordecai, who is a Jew, who his father had been taken into captivity, is an interesting name for him because the origin is in meaning a follower of Marduk, a Babylonian god. So Mordecai, who we don't have another name for, is known by the name of a pagan god and seemingly doing decently in Susa and wants to work his way into the government while taking care of Hadassah. Now, Hadassah is the Jewish name, which means myrtle tree, which, of course, I didn't know was a thing, but it is. You can Google it. A myrtle tree is a thing. That is Hebrew in origin, and symbolically, it means peace, love, and prosperity. Now, Esther, who she is called the rest of this story, means star, and it's Persian in origin, and it's possibly connected to the goddess of love, Ishtar, where we also get Easter from. In other mythologies would be Venus. But the star may have been, that name Esther, meaning star, may have been chosen due to the star-shaped flower of the myrtle tree. So Esther is her Persian name that is connected also to a pagan god. That might be because she's trying to conceal the fact that she is Jewish, and Mordecai is a name meaning a follower of a pagan god as well. So, what could possibly be implied from that is that Esther, who is plenty young, and Mordecai, who is not ancient, could have simply returned to Jerusalem if they had wanted. They did not. Also, Mordecai, at least, is only known by one name, his pagan name. And so we can infer, possibly, that Mordecai and Esther weren't super religious Jews. They were Jewish, they didn't forsake God, but they also were just kind of living their own life over in the Persian Empire, in their own city. They didn't really express any interest in going back to Jerusalem, to the place where God had made a covenant with his people, and they're just there. So as it so happens in this story, during the time where they're rounding up all the beautiful maidens of the land, they take Esther. The officials took her, and that's what it says, took her, not that she volunteered, not that she entered a slip into the contest. They took her into the first harem. And Mordecai had told Esther to not reveal her Jewish ethnicity, which again seems kind of questionable for people like Daniel, who are just bold about the fact that I worship Yahweh and that's all I do. Take it or leave it. Mordecai says, hide your Jewish ethnicity. This is foreshadowing, and this is referred to in verse 10 of chapter 2. So she acts just like any other Persian woman who was in this contest. She goes in, she takes the treatments that she's supposed to take, she eats the food. She gets singled out for extra special treatment because the eunuch in charge is like, I know the king's taste, so like you look like a good one, so we're going to set you over here and do extra special stuff. So Esther gets extra special treatment, and he waits for a long period of time to introduce Esther into this contest is the best way we can talk about it. And she follows his advice as far as what to do in preparation for her turn with Xerxes. Finally, in the 10th month, in the year, the 7th year of Xerxes, so about 478, Esther was sent to the king. So although there's no definite time period in this narrative that takes place of how long did this thing take to do, if we add up the 2 years that he was in Greece and then we get to the point where he gets his night with Esther, about 478, we're talking a year or two, where the king of Persia just says, next, and they send a different woman to him, and she gets sent to the next harem. Next, and we do this for a year or two. Eventually, it comes to be Esther's turn. So, chapter 2, let's see, verse 15. Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had adopted her as his own daughter, when her turn came to go to the king, she did not ask for anything. They were apparently allowed to ask for whatever, clothes and gold and all this stuff. She didn't ask for anything except what Haggai, the king's trusted official in charge of the harem, suggested. Esther won approval in the sight of everyone who saw her. She was taken to King Xerxes in the royal palace in the 10th month, the month Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. The king loved Esther more than all the other women. She won more favor and approval from him than did any of the other young women. He placed the royal crown on her head and made her queen in place of Vashti. The king held a great banquet for all his officials and staff. It was Esther's banquet. He freed his provinces from tax payments and gave gifts worthy of the king's bounty. So, as the story is told, Esther gets her turn, and immediately, Xerxes just falls deeply in love. It's like Cupid just shot him, right? Instantaneous attraction. It might not actually be the case. It leaves open for the fact that he actually remembered Esther. Like, he had gone on to the next woman, And he's like, you know, none of these other women are even close. Let's just call it off. Let's get Esther. So he calls Esther back. He makes Esther the queen of all of Persia. So, talk about a fairy tale, right? This is like Disney script, right? Take an orphan who doesn't have parents, who's raised by some random relative, a person who has been displaced from her people, becoming the queen of Persia. Xerxes throws another feast for all of his officials and staff to honor Esther. He then declares a holiday in celebration. But in all of this, it is quite unlikely that Xerxes' character changes at all. We love to think about this like it's a great big nice love story. But Xerxes is still an idiot. In the next couple of verses at the end of chapter 2, we see a transition, which we'll go ahead and cover this week. Xerxes has a new queen. He parades her around, more or less, with another coronation type thing to say, look at my beautiful queen. It's even possible Xerxes was trying to ignore the whole fact that he had a beautiful queen that ignored him the first time. He's just like saying, hey, look at this to everybody. Then what happens is Esther becomes queen. Mordecai gets a little bit of a promotion into an official government role. He's sitting at the king's gate, which is where the law and matters were solved. And so he was either a judge or some sort of lawyer or clerk or something. And then he overhears a plot from two eunuchs who are the guard to the king's bedroom. And he overhears that they're talking about killing him, about assassinating Xerxes. Side note, Xerxes does eventually get assassinated, which is another reason why best option is that Xerxes is this guy, because there were a lot of people who wanted Xerxes dead. Mordecai then sends word via Esther, because that was the only person in the palace he could trust, because he didn't know who all was involved in the plot, but he knew that Esther wasn't going to be involved in the plot of killing off the king, so he sends the Esther. Esther then tells Xerxes, my cousin Mordecai overheard this take place, so they look into it, found out, sure enough, they were planning to assassinate him. They then impale the two guys on sticks, which, again, you're going to see a lot of that in the Book of Esther. Persia really loves impaling people to publicly shame them for their actions, and they write down Mordecai's actions in historical records in the palace. Now, when an author includes that and then just moves on, that's usually an indication that that will come back later, just like Cyrus put it in writing, the whole, they wrote down what Mordecai did in the historical records, it'll come back later. So, this transition leads into the threats that are coming into the following chapters. But what we see in this three-verse section is that due to Xerxes' choice of the new queen, his life is saved. Had he chosen any of the other women, it is very likely he would have been assassinated. So Xerxes kind of owes Esther and Mordecai his life. People who he doesn't know are Jews, and there might be even rising anti-Semitic tendencies in the Persian Empire at this time, which is why Mordecai is saying, like, hey, just don't let anyone know that you're a Jew. Just gloss on over that. Xerxes, the great king of Persia, owes his life to his new queen and to Mordecai. And this will come in play later. This is where we're going to stop our narrative for the book of Esther. Again, I know I didn't read many of these verses. I tried my best to summarize them and get all the important things. You can feel free to go back and read those verses. But what lessons are we going to learn from these first two chapters of Esther? And let me tell you, that was the question I had for the longest time while I was trying to prepare. I was like, I feel like I need to include a couple extra chapters here so that I have a good, like, this is the lesson we can learn. But wouldn't you know, all of the scripture has lessons for us to learn. So let's see. I feel like there's like one main lesson with like a sub-lesson inside of it. So in case you didn't hear last week, the book of Esther does not mention God by name at all. Throughout this entire book, things happen, but no one says God did X, Y, or Z, or God told, or anything. There's not even a situation in here where like Mordecai is reading the law. We kind of have secularized Jews living in a pagan country trying to make life work for themselves. And yet things seem to happen. So although God isn't mentioned by name, his people are still living in exile. The events of these chapters demonstrate that God is still with his people. He's with his people over at the Blue Star in Jerusalem. He's also with his people still in exile in Susa. There are some great oddities in these first two chapters that can be best explained by God's providence, although hidden from the characters, is working still in Persia, the land that he exiled his people out to. God's providence is still at work, although the characters do not see it, although they do not know of it coming. They have no warning about it as to what God is doing. He is still at work. And how do we see that? Because he puts Esther, a Jew, as the beloved queen of Xerxes, the most powerful man in his time. The importance of this wasn't known ahead of time. Just like maybe if you haven't read the book of Esther, you don't know what the big deal is about Esther being the queen. It's a big deal for many different reasons. Although they didn't know it ahead of time, no one came to Esther and said, like, hey, we're going to have you, like, go into the king's house, become a queen, it's going to be great, and you're going to do all these things. No one told Esther anything. Also, this wasn't something that was necessarily even desirable for Mordecai or Esther. However, God was working behind the scenes to accomplish his sovereign purposes over the purposes of Xerxes, which is exactly what God has been doing with the entire history of the Persian Empire. So what are we going to learn from this? Is that God's sovereign plans and purposes for our lives may not appear as something desirable for us either. So let's think about it. Esther, who was a displaced Jew and an orphan, was taken into the king's harem, which means that she was then taken away from having a chance to marry a man from Israel, to establish her own family, and to fall in love in their own culture. Somewhere around 16 to 18, somewhere in that age frame, she was taken and said, you don't get a choice in the matter. You're part of the king's harem now, and you'll get one chance with the king. And after that, if he doesn't call for you by name, you're just done. She has nothing to choose. You think that sounds like something you'd want to sign up for? Doesn't seem like something desirable, and it's not good for Mordecai either because he's been taking care of her since her parents died, and now she gets taken away, and he has to like walk around the courtyard to hear gossip about Esther, who he treats as his own daughter. This is not something that they would have likely wanted. And then Esther was left with only two possible outcomes, which makes this whole thing even worse. One, she doesn't please Xerxes and becomes virtually a widow in the palace harem. She shows up to Xerxes and Xerxes is like, nah, not cutting it. And you just get sent to this harem where you're never allowed to marry anyone. And then the king's not going to remember you. So you're basically a widow for the rest of your life. Sure, you get to live in the palace, but you're all alone. That doesn't sound like a good outcome either. But the other outcome that is possible is that she ends up married to a hot-headed, sex-driven, power-hungry, depressed drunk who sees his queen as property worth displaying for his own glory. Talk about a lose-lose situation, right? You either lose and you don't end up having a romantic relationship at all. And if you win, you still lose because the guy you're marrying is a loser. This isn't the pretty princess picture in our heads from all the Disney princess movies. But neither is God's plan necessarily for us. Just because we are God's people does not guarantee that our lives will work out in any way we desire. The way that your life is working out, even though you don't know about the importance or the reason or the plan ahead of time, God's providence is still at work in your life as it was in Jerusalem, as it was in Susa. So we, like Mordecai and like Esther, need to accept that the circumstances in our lives are often outside of our control. However, they are not outside of God's control. As people who believe in God, we know that the circumstances that we face in life are often things that we cannot control. Yet we do know the God who is in control of all the circumstances that we face. They might not be something desirable, they might not be something positive, but they are something that God is in control of. God's timing of getting Esther into the royal household and Mordecai into a government official role leads to the saving of Xerxes' life. And although Xerxes doesn't realize it yet, God has mercifully just saved him from death because God isn't done with the king just yet. I'll talk about all the terrible circumstances in Esther and Mordecai's life. Mordecai's father gets deported out of Israel. Mordecai gets born into Babylonian captivity. His little cousin has been orphaned, so he takes care of her. He moves into Susa, overseeing Persia, taking over Babylon. And then she gets taken by the king. Then she ends up becoming queen, which sounds really cool on its face, but you're married to this loser. And then God does it just in time, the way the story said it, just in time for Mordecai to hear, your bodyguards that watch you sleep at night are going to stab you in the neck. Now, why would God be interested in keeping around? For that, you have to come back next week. So let us be aware that the circumstances in our lives might not be great, but God was in control of all of them. And although we won't likely know why those are the circumstances we face, we know that we know the God who is in control of them all, and so we can have confidence that he is with us. As he was with, yes, the Jews rebuilding Jerusalem, but still in Persia at the same time with Esther, who was just a scared little girl who was very beautiful, who has now become queen of this massive empire. All because God was working his plans and purposes faster, better, and wiser than Xerxes. Dear and Father, thank you for this story of Esther and how you, even without your name being plastered all over the page, were active in the events and the people leading to your plans to rescue Xerxes' life and to rescue your people. We thank you that you are a God who is better and wiser than the enemy, that you always know what you are doing well in advance. And although we, as characters in your story, might not see it all, that we know that you are at work, that you are still the same God who works all things out for your glory and for our good. And we pray that we would learn to trust you in that, that we would be able to see you at work even when we don't have forewarning, even when we don't hear directly from you, that we know that you are at work because of the way things work out. And we pray that although our lives might not turn out all hunky-dory and like a fairy tale, that we would know you for who you are and by the actions that you take. We pray that as we continue to study the book of Esther, that we would see you around each set of circumstances to get a better idea of who you are and your care for us. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.